Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So if you take a second to think about what is happening inside your cells right now, you might picture like a quiet or static environment.
Yeah, which is definitely not the case.
Right, not at all. The reality is that there is a massive biological engineering operation happening inside you at this very moment. Your cells need to mass produce these short essential RNAs, things like tRNAs.
Like the fundamental building blocks.
Exactly. And your cells have to manufacture these at an absolute industrial scale, nonstop, just to keep you alive. And the machine doing all this heavy lifting is called RNA polymerase III, or POL3.
Which is an incredibly fast machine.
It is. It's this highly efficient microscopic factory. But scientists run into a major problem when they actually try to study it. When we try to take a picture of this molecular machine in action using, you know, incredibly high resolution microscopes, one crucial part of the machine becomes entirely invisible.
It just disappears.
Yeah. Okay, let's unpack this. It's like taking a photograph of a race car. The body of the car is crystal clear, but the tires are just a blur because they're spinning so fast. How do we study a part of our cellular machinery that won't hold still? What really happens when this invisible moving part is in action? And how could capturing it change our understanding of cellular efficiency?
Well, today we celebrate the work of the research team at Academia Sinica in Taiwan, who have advanced our understanding of RNA polymerase III dynamics.
Which is so exciting.
It really is. By using some truly ingenious biochemical techniques, they basically managed to freeze that blurred race car tire in time. They mapped its precise microscopic movements, you know?
Right.
And in doing so, they uncovered a beautifully orchestrated mechanism of genetic regulation that we couldn't see before.
And we have to recognize what a monumental achievement this is, especially when you think about the sheer scale of what we are looking at. I mean, when we talk about POL3, we aren't talking about some simple tiny protein.
Oh, not at all.
If you're picturing a compact enzyme, you really have to scale your imagination way up. This thing is massive.
It is an absolute behemoth. POL3 is actually the largest of the three nuclear RNA polymerases in our cells. I mean, we're talking about 17 distinct subunits that have to perfectly assembled together.
Wow.
Yeah, that's roughly 6,600 amino acids. It has a combined molecular mass of approximately 0.7 megadaltons.
That is wild.
In the molecular world, it's a sprawling factory complex, and its job is highly specialized, making structural and non-coding RNAs. These transcripts are short, but they are absolutely essential for survival. POL3 actually produces these transcripts at a volume that exceeds all other RNA species in the cell combined.
So it's the ultimate high-volume manufacturing plant. And, you know, the reason you should care about the mechanics of this specific factory is that when it breaks down or when it loses its speed control and starts overproducing, the consequences for human health are severe.
Absolutely severe.
Dysregulation here isn't trivial. It is directly linked to neurodegenerative disorders, and it's a major driver in various forms of cancer.
Right, because tumor cells will literally hijack this machinery to fuel their own unchecked growth.
Exactly. The clinical stakes are just incredibly high here. So to understand the specific mystery for our deep dive today, we need to zoom in on one specific piece of this giant 17 subunit factory. It's a subunit called RPC34.
Yep, RPC34.
And within that, there is a tiny, highly mobile region known as the second winged helix domain, or WH2. This WH2 domain is our blurry race car tire from the analogy earlier.
That is the one. And, you know, from previous static biochemical studies, we know this WH2 domain is critical during the very first step of transcription, which we call initiation.
Right, getting the whole process started.
Exactly. Its job is to help pry open the DNA double helix at the promoter region so the machine can latch on. And during this initiation phase, the WH2 domain sits in a very specific, rigidly anchored spot.
Like, you can actually see it?
Yeah, we can see it clearly on our high-resolution cryo-EM scans. But once the machine finishes initiating and actually starts traveling down the DNA to copy it, the elongation phase, the WH2 domain just completely vanishes from the cryo-EM structures.
It's just gone.
The physical density on the image disappears. It's replaced by a blur.
Okay, but wait, I have to challenge this a bit. If this WH2 domain is flapping around so wildly during elongation that microscopes can't see it, how do we know it's actually doing something useful?
That's a very fair question.
Right. Couldn't it just be hanging on for the ride, totally inactive until the next cycle? Like it's just dangling there, waiting to pry open the DNA for the next round?
And that exact skepticism is what drove this entire research project. You can't just assume a protein domain is functionally silent just because a static photograph can't capture its movement.
Makes sense.
So to definitively answer if it was just dangling or actively doing something, the research team had to throw out static pictures entirely. They needed to measure it dynamically in real time on a single functioning molecule.
Which sounds, frankly, impossible. I mean, you can't just strap a microscopic GoPro camera onto a protein domain.
No, definitely not.
So how did they actually track this motion?
They used a really brilliant technique called SEMFRET. That stands for Single Molecule Fischer Resonance Energy Transfer. It basically uses quantum physics and fluorescence to measure incredibly tiny distances.
Okay, so for those listening who maybe aren't quantum physicists, let's break that down. It's basically like a molecular GPS system. You attach two fluorescent dyes to the complex. One is a donor dye and the other is an acceptor dye.
Right.
And when you shine a laser on the donor dye, it absorbs the energy. If the acceptor dye is physically very close to it, the donor transfers its energy over and the acceptor lights up.
Exactly.
But if the acceptor moves further away, less energy transfers. So by measuring the light, you calculate the exact distance between them in real time.
It is an incredibly precise molecular ruler. It can measure distances down to a fraction of a nanometer. So in this setup, they needed a fixed point to measure from. They put the donor dye on a stationary spot on the DNA template, specifically downstream at the plus 7 position.
So that's the fixed satellite.
Yes. And then they needed to attach the acceptor dye directly onto our blurry race car tire, the WH2 domain. They targeted a specific amino acid called lysine 126.
Okay, but getting that dye onto just one specific lysine on a 17 subunit 0.7 megadalton beast without ruining the complex, that has to be a massive chemical roadblock.
It was a huge roadblock. Yeah. You need the dye to attach to only that one spot. So they used a bioorthogonal chemistry approach, specifically a copper-free click chemistry technique called SPAKE.
Okay, let's translate that because the chemistry here is wild.
It really is. Basically, they genetically engineered the yeast cells to incorporate a completely unnatural amino acid right at that lysine 126 spot. This unnatural amino acid had a unique chemical handle called an azide.
So they essentially built a custom docking station into the protein.
Exactly. Then they took their fluorescent dye and equipped it with a complementary handle, a strain cycloctane. It acts like a loaded spring trap. When it hits the azide docking station, it instantly snaps together. And they could do it copper-free, which is vital because copper would destroy the protein.
In theory, the dye exclusively snaps onto the WH2 domain.
Right, in theory.
But biology is messy.
So messy. When they ran it, they hit a severe off-target problem. The giant Pol-3 complex is naturally covered in natural cysteines, which contain thiols. The cycloctane accidentally reacted wildly with all these natural thiols all over the giant complex.
Oh no. So it's like trying to spray paint one specific custom doorknob in a massive mansion, but the paint accidentally sticks to every metal hinge in the house. You can't track your doorknob if the whole mansion is glowing.
That is perfectly said. To fix it, they innovated a thiol capping strategy using a molecule called MMTS. Before adding the dye, they treated the complex with MMTS to block all the natural cysteines.
So the MMTS is basically molecular painter's tape. You tape up the normal hinges first, so only your custom doorknob gets painted.
Exactly. And the MMTS didn't damage the machine. It could still transcribe RNA perfectly. Overcoming this was a massive technical triumph.
Okay, so they taped the hinges, painted the doorknob, and fired up the lasers. What did the data actually show? Was the domain just flailing randomly?
The SEMFRET data definitively proved it is not just flailing randomly. It dynamically transitions between three highly specific discrete positional states across the DNA binding cleft.
Three specific states. Let's break these down based on the FRET efficiencies and dwell times. So first we have the distal state. This one has a low FRET efficiency of about 0.27, and it lasts for about 1.4 seconds, right?
Yeah, 1.4 seconds, and physically it's located way upstream.
Okay, and then the middle state. The efficiency jumps to a middle FRET of 0.52, and it hangs out there longer, lasting about 3.1 seconds, located central to the cleft.
Correct, and finally the proximal state. High FRET efficiency of 0.68, and it parks there for a solid 9.4 seconds. It's located all the way downstream.
But hold on, Summit R8 just gives you a linear distance, it's just a radius. How did they map where these three spots are in 3D space?
Well, what's fascinating here is how the team used a nano positioning system, or NPS, to literally triangulate these exact locations in 3D space.
Wait, like how cell towers triangulate a phone?
Exactly like that.
Yeah.
They ran parallel experiments with multiple fixed satellites. They put a donor dye on the downstream DNA, then ran it again with a donor dye on the upstream DNA. They even attached the acceptor dye to a different side of the WH2 domain to get its orientation.
That is so elegant.
It really is. And the pathway it takes is strictly ordered. It doesn't jump randomly from distal to proximal. It always, without fail, moves through the middle state.
So what does this all mean? Why is this piece hopping between these three specific spots in such an ordered way?
It acts like a dynamic cover or clamp for the DNA. It stabilizes the transcription bubble so the DNA doesn't accidentally snap shut or fall out while it's being copied.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and this is a conserved evolutionary strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Pole 1 uses a domain called RPE49TWH for this, and Pole 2 uses factors like CB5, NGN, and ELF1.
Mm-hmm.
Mobile DNA-engaging cleft covers are just how evolution solves this problem.
So it's basically holding the whole operation together.
Right. But there is one more big implication here: rapid reinitiation. The researchers noticed that the distal position during this elongation phase physically overlaps with where the WH2 domain sits before transcription even starts, back in the pre-initiation complex.
Oh wait, here's where it gets really interesting. It's like a line cook at a busy restaurant.
Yes.
Even while they are plating one dish the elongation phase, they are already reaching their arm back to grab the ticket for the next order, which is reinitiation. This mobility explains how Pole 30 can rapid fire these short RNAs out so fast.
That line cook analogy is spot on. To sum it all up, the RPC34WH2 domain is not a rigid gear. It's a highly mobile, predictable module that actively stabilizes the DNA copying process while simultaneously positioning the machine for rapid reuse. It reveals a beautiful truth about biology that deliberate flexibility rather than rigid structure is what drives cellular efficiency.
That is just incredible. And, you know, it leaves you with something really profound to think about. If this deliberate molecular wobble is what allows our cells to function at high speeds, what does this mean for our ability to engineer new synthetic biological machines or design specific drugs when this rapid-fire process dysregulates into cancer? It completely changes how we approach bioengineering. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
Under cold white lights, the strand starts to glow. A quiet machine where the small scripts flow. One little wing keeps changing where it lands. Holding the bubble with invisible hands. Close then middle then drifting away. Counting the seconds it chooses to stay. No straight jump, there's a rule in the ride. It always passes through the center line. Three places to hold the fire in the cleft. A flicker of contact, but it's all you've got left. We tie strong timing, it steadies the view. So the message keeps moving,
so the run comes through. so it ends.
And it starts
with a bright reclaim.